You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. You're listening to Sound Poetry, Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 FM. I'm your host, David Gilmore, with Seattle poet, writer, editor, and educator. He's taught for many, many years. Classical violinist. He enjoys birds, photography, Zen, and yoga. His name is Rick Clark of Seattle, and maybe some of you have heard him at readings. He is an author of poetry, long poem writer, variety of subject matter, human and nature. But now he's turned to haiku. He's the author of a volume, Bug-Eyed and Bird-Brained Small Creature Haiku by the Red Moon Press. And it's also illustrated by a Northwest Sumi artist, Fumiko Kimura. Some of you might know of her. His haiku are frequently included in anthologies. He's won many international contests. In fact, he found his niche by seeing how well his haiku was received. And that's always a good way to know which direction you might head. He's also a filmmaker. I won't mention those films. If you go to his blog, Renzai Insight Journal, W-R-E-N-Z-A-I, Insight Journal, you might find information in that regard about some films that he helped with scripting and perhaps producing for. In fact, he was spearheading one that was an ALS fundraiser called Rowing Smitty. And that can be seen on our local television, right?
Yes, the Seattle channel has it archived up there, Rowing Smitty.
But welcome, Rick Clark, to Sound Poetry.
It is a privilege for me. I've never been on the radio, so this is pretty exciting. I thought maybe I would start with a haiku that did place first place in the international category in a Japanese haiku contest. And that's when I suddenly realized, hey, I guess I can write haiku. I should probably continue to pursue this and maybe try to get published. And so that was kind of the beginning of my serious interest in haiku. This haiku I actually wrote as I was looking out my sister's window at her apartment in Fremont, Seattle, and I saw it, and I wrote it down, and really didn't have to change the wording too much. I did change a few words. That's the way I work. I tend to observe until something strikes me and I write something down, and maybe it'll be a haiku, maybe it won't, but that's the way I work. Sometimes I look at old memories, but I look at my old memories in the same way that I look at the present reality. This haiku goes like this. The one-legged sparrow, still embraced by the clan on the power line. The one-legged sparrow, still embraced by the clan on the power line. I lived in Japan for 4 years teaching English as a second language. I met my wife there, and we discovered that people who had handicaps and were challenged in various ways were not very evident in the culture at that time. That was late 80s, early 90s. Fran developed a relationship with a woman who had cerebral palsy, who I assume is still with us. And I think that behind this poem is my experience with Japan, where these people were not really allowed out in public at that time. I think it may have changed by now. And so it was kind of a beautiful irony that this poem placed in this contest in Japan. I thought it boded well for people to be able to come out into public.
Yes, that's right. thoughts that you had mentioned about the handicapped or those that are in some way unable to make it easily up steps and streets and so on. Some countries like Italy do with cobblestones. Can you imagine being in a wheelchair on cobblestones? And yet that's another place that used to hide people away. Yeah. But anyway, you're going on with another one. These images come to you and the importance that you can give them that maybe the listener doesn't pick up on.
I was talking with a well-established haiku poet at some point, and he said to me that haiku very much are about the references we make to older haiku, to ancient haiku, and how we update on those ideas. And this second haiku that I'd like to share with you does that. Basho, who is the grandfather of the modern haiku in Japan, the best known haiku poet in history, I believe, wrote a poem about a neighbor. And so now you occasionally see neighbor haiku and neighbor senru out there. And I did the same thing. The Basho poem goes like this. This is my translation. Autumn deepens. Next door, what is my neighbor doing? My version is our loner neighbor, his clematis creeping onto our balcony. I was a little worried that somebody might get the wrong idea about our neighbor. He's a fine guy. We adore him. He's the gardener of the condo building. And I've since kind of rewritten that haiku to give it a little more positive spin. I've made several attempts at that. That haiku placed second in the European kukai in winter of 2017. A kukai is a kind of contest in Japan in which everyone participates. Everyone that submits a poem also has to judge all of the poems and give points. And this kukai has been going on in Europe for some time, and I attempted to get a good score for, well, I have to say years, and finally I got one that did pretty well. With all things, it takes many, many, many hours and lots of practice to kind of figure it out how to do it, and I'm still in that middle of that process.
Well, when you think of your own real neighbor and worried about the neighbor there, that shows your interest in your own thoughts and your own feelings about, but those that don't know your neighbor or wonder whether he's being put down as a loner, in reading that there's such a subtle connectedness between the neighbors, with the clematis doing the communicating through its creeping, right? And so it's taken just for you know what it is without knowing personalities or worrying about personalities. You get away from concern and worry about the loner. There's that little communication going on there.
Yes. And yeah. I love the tradition of the neighbor haiku. I think it's something that is good for humankind to write haikus about our neighbors, or to be thinking about our neighbors in these open and questioning ways.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you're going to go on to another winner. There was a Basho winner in the international haiku, right?
Yes. I'd like to preface this third one that did well. It was during the time that all these fires were going on down in Australia and all these animals were trying to escape, and the coverage was rather gruesome about the animals that weren't able to escape the fire. And of course, it was winter here at at that time. And so, and I keep a hummingbird feeder using suction cups attached to my window where I sit right here and work. And I watch the hummingbirds when they come. And I looked up and it had been snowing and the hummingbird was buzzing all around the feeder and couldn't even land because the little twig-like piece of plastic wasn't exposed. And so I watched the hummingbird and he tried to land and I felt like his eye was looking in at me like, can't you remove this snow so I can get this nectar? I can smell it. I can see it. And his eye was, it looked exactly like a human eye.
Yeah.
I felt like I was connected with him. And we're only about 3-4 feet apart, just with the glass between us. And this haiku popped out. And it goes like this. The very human eye of the hummingbird, snow on the feeder. And I find that a lot of the haiku I write actually have a context. There's something already operating in the background for a haiku to emerge. And I would say that that's the case, particularly in the first that I've shared here and this third one, where there is a historical or a natural event that is playing out to cause me to see this a haiku in this little tiny event in front of me.
Well, your explanation there of the situation, again, shows that connectedness, that human eye. The bird is looking at you as though it had human eyes. And you've explained the thoughtfulness in the eyes to trying to persuade you, encourage you, or at least gain your help, your aid. This does grow very large after we've heard that preamble too. But even by itself, I think a reader would take time with that and realize that, oh, there's something, there's an incapability here of some sort. Because the hummingbird we think of as a summer bird, right?
Yes.
We think of it, the seasonality of haiku is sometimes important, but not always. Maybe in this one is. Yeah,
I think that the seasonality is actually very important. In fact, it points to what seasonality is as compared to Japanese kigo. Kigo means season or season word. And they use them traditionally in their haiku to give a sense of what season it is. So automatically you have a context of nature in which a haiku is set. But the irony here is that the seasonality in Australia was the opposite of the seasonality that we were having here with the show. And so it kind of makes a point about seasonality, that seasonality is relative. We can't use the Japanese kigos because they're different over here. If you're in Hawaii, you can't use the Japanese kigos. And I know there's a lot of Japanese people writing haiku in Hawaii, but they have to adjust their kigo.
Right. Imaginative kigos.
Yes.
Yeah.
Palms, you know, coconuts.
Right. Nature does figure very largely in most haikus that I think of, although I do know there are those that are connected to, oh, the Buddha and human Zen activity, the activity of the Buddhist monk, which don't always have, they have the human nature, but they don't always have just maybe a bare semblance of the nature out there with a season or some touch about a tree or something like that. Mm-hmm. But you have used sparrow once before. Now you've got twilight sparrows. So you've already helped us with the sparrow image. We've got that one. It's there. It's lurking in sight, perched, ready for this haiku. The idea of your sparrow to become sparrows. Now we enlarge it to numbers of them.
Well, the haiku that you're referring to might not have been published in Frog Pond if I had left it in that shape, which is a traditional three-line shape, approximating the 5-7-5 pattern of tradition. But I actually read a very nice essay by Jim Kasian, who is the founder of Red Moon Press, and it was about using shapes and typography and a graphic approach to presenting a haiku on a page. And I was inspired by it. I don't tend to lean in that direction. He tends to push a lot of envelopes in different directions in his writing. So I decided, because of the language and the image, to write the haiku in a circle. And they put it on the back of the Frog Pond. And they liked it enough that they put it on the back of the Frog Pond journal, which is kind of the best known haiku journal in English around. And so I witnessed this. My wife and I had a home in Ocean Shores for a while, and we had some compost barrels. And if I went out at the tail end of the evening, when in the twilight, there'd usually be some sparrows scratching around out there. And they loved the compost barrels because the compost barrels would be leaking tiny bits of what seed and vegetable matter. And they would dig little trenches as they went around the compost barrel. It was pretty interesting.
Well, that's interesting. Then you've got the circle, the barrel. From this distance, I'm not able to read because of my prescription, okay, but my poor vision doesn't allow me unless I get very close to read it. And from here, I see birds. I see bird flight. Of course, you've got the twilight above. And so you've got a couple of circles. The ones around it, the twilight and the sparrows, are actually circling that barrel.
Yeah, and I tried to make the circle continuous. So twilight sparrows scratching deep ruts around the compost barrel, scratching deep ruts around the compost barrel. It just goes around and around and around. And it was a lot of fun to play with on the computer. I tried a couple of them. I give a salute to Jim Kasian of Red Moon Press for that inspiration.
Well, they saw something more than just what the words meant in your design, that's for sure. That was a really good turn that you thought of there.
It was fun.
This is the writer's house party, a haiku senrutanka, a volume of different entities that describe those, yeah.
Yeah, they're different kinds of poems, the senru being the human nature type haiku and the tanka being a five line. It used to be called a waka. It's a five liner, and oftentimes it's a three plus two liner. So you still kind of have that three liner in there. This pleased me because it was published in Nick Virgilio's Writer's House Poetry Journal, their first volume. And I liked a lot of the poets that were included in that journal. This is a story that harks to a story about my interest in music. When I was a kid, I was studying the violin. I shocked my parents by coming home one day and saying I wanted to take violin lessons, and their jaws dropped. I actually had written a phone number from the poster at the school and handed it to them, and they got me lessons, and they leased an instrument to buy, and I started in. After a couple of years, my teacher thought I should get a mirror because I needed to watch myself play, that kind of feedback loop would be helpful to me. The haiku tells what actually happened. Violin student asks his dad for a mirror, gets a tape recorder. And that is so my dad. That kind of sums him up in a way. You know, he was the kind of person that didn't really want us kids to be vain or to seek too much attention. And so the idea of me playing the violin, looking at myself in the mirror, just was too much for my father. And he said, you know, concentrate on the sound. Don't worry about how you look.
That's right. And also, because he gave you that particular kind of medium to use, it also helps you to place this in time. Your violin life, you're still continuing that, are you?
I still play the violin probably about 7 or 8 hours a week, an hour a day. Relationship to that instrument is one of practice, not necessarily practicing to perform, but having it as a practice to keep my mind sharp, my fingers nimble, and my posture erect. It's a practice for me, and it's half of my exercise regime is the violin. If I do it right and I apply my full body to it, I'm getting pretty good exercise. Sometimes I'm breathing hard after I've been playing for a while. Sometimes my muscles are sore. I don't know how some of these big professionals and stage performers do it. You know, if they play like the Sibelius violin concerto for an hour and a half straight, and in a big way, such that their sound fills the space and echoes around. How do they do that? It takes so much power and control and precision and feeling, you know, to get it out there like that. So even just aspiring to that, I benefit. And, you know, occasionally I perform a little something, you know, but.
Music, poetry, you know, that they're not very far apart, those.
No.
So you've got to have once in a while that. One intrude on the other, but not always. When you take a break, there's one here from the Frog Pond, the Journal of Haiku Society of America, that's really of another order that I think normal human behaviors. But what happens in the midst of those behaviors?
I have to say that my main project in my life right now is ancestry research, writing how-to memoir. So it's a kind of a complex structure that I'm going to try to make as easy to consume as possible. So I've been researching ancestors. I've been writing about ancestors. I've been building a huge archive. At this point, I have about 10 gigabytes of material that either I have found or produced. It's a giant project. I've been working on it for 8 years, and I'm doing it for my family. But I thought, well, as long as I'm doing this, I may as well make a book. This haiku that you mentioned, I think I would call it a senryu. And, you know, we were living in Ocean Shores part-time, and I love to go outside, you know, and take care of business. And so this haiku goes like this. Pissing into the dark, I think of my ancestors next in line. And I'm so occupied with the project that I just, even standing outside in the dark, I'm thinking about this project. I'm thinking about these ancestors, and I'm learning about them, and, you know, all of them, all the way back to five greats, casting light on the darkness that once was our knowledge of our ancestors. We knew nothing. I did not know my grandfather's first name.
In doing some of your research, of course, you write about friends that you had and your family. The anthologies that you have mentioned here, there's an animal rights haiku that Robert Epstein puts out, right? Every chicken, cow, fish, and frog.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the title of one of the animal rights haiku volumes?
It's just a single volume. It's a rather thick one. He had a very good turnout for that particular anthology. It's not a regular or routine journal. It was a one-time thing. And he added a lot of appendices to it, including organizations you can get involved with and for animal rights. I think this was the first time I submitted to Robert Epstein, and I really like what he does. He's really thinking about life on the planet. He's thinking about aging. He's thinking about caregiving, other kinds of struggles, you know, memory possibly. I think he asked us to send 10, and he chose these four. I'll read one of them. A friend's friend. Killed in Mali, I resist swatting a fruit fly. I had this leather-topped desk, and the leather was pretty gabby, actually. And for some reason, the fruit flies were attracted to it. And so I had, I'd be working and writing, and next thing you'd know, I'd have two or three fruit flies flying around there, interested in the leather, and I watched him, and I just kind of thought, you know, technically that fruit fly has every right to its life as we do. I have a right to my life, and in that way we're on a par,
right? So that's it's a haiku because of it going down to that minute insect, and you Issa is two S's, right?
Yes, yeah, and the I in Japanese.
You mentioned the name. This is a somewhat specialized in its going to the minute.
In one of the categories I have here under Haiga, Haibun, and educational, I got an invitation to submit to David Lanaue's Write Like Issa Haiku How To. And it's a really cute little book, and it's a great book to buy as a gift for anyone who's interested in haiku, especially writing haiku, who also likes small creatures. The haiku that we submitted, the ones that he chose, he used to demonstrate how to write like Issa, how to write a sympathetic or compassionate poem in which we're learning something from this tiny creature that we might otherwise overlook or swat. The first one that I wrote here is border crossing. A cabbage butterfly flits from daisy to daisy. And he actually did find an Issa haiku that was similar to that. And I hadn't seen it. And it was more about how a certain insect was free to pass through the prison walls, where this person in the prison was not free to pass through the prison walls. I was at the Canadian border, and we were moving up slowly to re-enter the United States. And I was looking out of my brother's pickup truck from the passenger seat, and I looked down and I saw these daisies, and there was this butterfly just flitting freely, you know, right across the border from one daisy to the other. And no problem with borders.
In the three that you've added in the anthologies here, there are insects and animals that you're showing an empathetic concern for. One of them less subtle than the other. The other's quite emphatically a sympathy, a concern for. But the other one's subtle. Read the one flap of a fan.
Yeah. My wife, Fran, and I were in Sayulita, Mexico around Christmas time. A lot of places down there don't have air conditioning, but they'll have a nice fan. I saw this incident, and I felt really horrible when I saw it. It's a little hard to share, but I will. A flap of a fan blade, a faceless butterfly clings to the wall. And I tried to save that poor creature, and I took it outside. I put some water by it, but of course it didn't make it. I checked the next morning, and it was gone.
Right, and we better be careful when we have one of these objects in our hands, the one that shoots.
Oh, yeah. Well, I have to say that my compassion was slipping and sliding a little bit with the squirrels out there in Ocean Shores. One female got into our roof and had babies, and then eventually managed to leap the babies over to a branch and get out of the roof and move on to the next stage of their lives. And then from that time on, that mother squirrel and her offspring wanted to get into our roof. When you're in your home and you hear all this scratching and scrappling and squeaking and squealing, and after a while you start kind of building a little rage. But in this case, the compassion won out. And the haiku goes this way. The squirrel I thought to shoot, drinking casually from our planter. I did patch the roof very carefully. Thank you for contacting me about doing this. It's just been so much fun.
It was our pleasure to have you on Sound Poetry. I've been your host, David Gilmore, with Seattle poet Rick Clark.